Good morning. I'm going to have our marshal call the next case for consideration.
This case is A21-0250, Maureen A. Chevalier, respondent versus Mark K. Thomas, appellant.
And good morning again. Counsel, the panel has already been identified. I want to remind you of the time frame you each have for presentation of your argument. 15 minutes appears on the clock in my upper left-hand corner. Appellant counsel will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to exercise that option. And when you're ready to proceed, please introduce yourself and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. Michael Boulette here on behalf of appellant Dr. Mark Thomas. Your Honor, in 2020, after experiencing a $250,000 decline in income, Dr. Thomas objected to a cost of living adjustment that would have brought his spousal maintenance obligation to over $21,000 per month. Despite this decline in income, the district court granted that cost of living adjustment over Dr. Thomas's objection, and it did so principally based on an error of law by applying a portion of the party's stipulated divorce decree that by its terms applied only for the purposes of modifying maintenance to Dr. Thomas's contest of a cost of living adjustment. On appeal, we've identified two principal errors for the court. The first is a legal issue that this court reviews de novo, which is whether or not the court applied the incorrect legal standard and an incorrect baseline to Dr. Thomas's objection to a cost of living adjustment. The second is an issue this court reviews for an abuse of discretion, which is whether the court erred by implementing a cost of living adjustment, adjusting Dr. Thomas's obligation to more than $21,000 each month when he'd experienced a decline in income over any relevant period in consideration. To begin with, the correct standard to be applied. Upon divorce, whenever spousal maintenance is entered, the court provides for a statutory cost of living adjustment. The notion of this adjustment is that as inflation takes impact over time, a maintenance recipient can come and seek an upward adjustment in their maintenance based on the increase in consumer price index. Critically, this is distinct from a spousal maintenance modification. As both parties agree here, these are not the same thing. They are independent proceedings that exist for two different purposes.
Under 518A. Mr. Boulette, if I can jump in quickly too, because I think there's another potential distinction that may be important. What do you think the relationship is between the cost of living adjustment and I'll read from the stipulation here, establishing the award of spousal maintenance? Is there a distinction between establishing the award and adjusting it for cost of living?
There is a distinction there as well, Your Honor. And the distinction is twofold, right? First and foremost, the distinction between modification and cost of living adjustment impacts what information we look at, right? In looking at a modification, we're going to look at all the party circumstances and all their income considerations. And critically, if the parties enter a private agreement with respect to their right to modify maintenance, we will respect that as well. A cost of living adjustment provides us a much narrower inquiry. And that narrow inquiry, Judge Bryan, I think is precisely what you are pointing to, which is, has this obligor's income, has the payor's income, increased over the period in review? Has it increased since maintenance was last adjusted? If it has, and this court's decisions in Bratz and McClellan and Blomgren and Krogstad all point to this, if there's been an increase in the obligor's income, a court has discretion to provide for an adjustment to maintenance based on the increase in the consumer price index. If there has not been an increase in income since that last cost of living adjustment, then the court should decline to increase maintenance for the cost of living for the simple proposition that if the obligor's income hasn't gone up, maintenance shouldn't go up, notwithstanding the fact that there's been some inflation, because both parties are going to have to bear the burden of that inflation from incomes that haven't increased. So what you point to, Judge Bryan, I think is critical, which is we don't look to the incomes that the parties use to establish maintenance. We look to their incomes as they have existed along the road. So just as in this court's decision in Hagen, the relevant time frame is the last point in time that Ms. Chevalier applied for a cost of living adjustment, when Dr. Thomas's income had hit an all-time high. When we measure from that point downward, we have a $250,000 decrease in income. But critically, Your Honor, and I think this is really the key point in our principal brief, as well as the key error in the district court's order, all of that language about the income for establishing spousal maintenance is prefaced by language that the district court entirely ignored, which is that this language is intended for the purposes of any future modification of spousal maintenance. We say it in our brief, I'll say it again here, the parties meant this so much they went out of their way to say it twice. All of the language upon which the district court relied was expressly prefaced for the purposes of modifying maintenance only.
Your position, Mr. Bullett, is that the stipulation was unambiguous. The district court didn't make any such determination. I don't recall who the trial judge was. Was it necessary in the modification hearing for the judge to make a determination one way or the other that it was unambiguous to go ahead or not?
It wasn't necessary. It is our position, Judge Werke, that this language is unambiguous, right? The parties meant what they said in their stipulated decree, which is Dr. Thomas's retirement is coming up. We need to have a plan to figure out how we will modify maintenance when that eventuality arrives. But the language that the district court relied upon means exactly what it says, which is it is only for the purpose of a maintenance modification, not for the purpose of contesting a cost of living adjustment. And just like in this court's decision in Graycheck, we do not read stipulated language that applies to maintenance modifications to extend to a cost of living adjustment unless the parties tell us that is exactly what they intend. Here, the parties told us no such thing. What the parties told us here is that we have a specific agreement with respect to a future motion to modify maintenance. We have no such agreement with respect to any cost of living adjustment, so the statute applies. As I turn to your question, Judge Werke, there was no real need to determine if the language is ambiguous or to construe it because no party argued the language was ambiguous. No party suggested that the words for the purposes of maintenance modification should mean anything other than what they say. For that reason, the court never found that they were ambiguous. It never purported to construe the decree to say, well, I know the parties say this, but reasonably speaking and based on collateral evidence. In addition, even if the court had wanted to engage in that analysis, because neither party argued ambiguity, neither party provided any extrinsic evidence that would say, here's how you know what this document means. Here's how you know this document means something other than what it said. And this basic error, applying the language in the party stipulation relative only to maintenance modification, flows through to the remainder of the court's order. Because by finding that this $650,000 baseline was the measure against which Dr. Thomas had to, in essence Dr. Thomas's threshold to be able to prevail in his motion, the court proceeded to avoid the real analysis here, which is that Dr. Thomas's income is down on every relevant period of comparison. It's absolutely down from its 2017 high immediately before Ms. Chevalier received her last maintenance adjustment, her last COLA. It's down from 2016 when the parties actually divorced. It's down even from 2014, which is the income figure cited in the findings of fact in the decree. Over any relevant time period, Dr. Thomas's income is down. And what the statute tells us, what 518A75 subdivision 3 tells us, is when you have a decline in income, we don't increase the obligee's maintenance for the cost of living because the obligor hasn't experienced a commensurate increase of his own.
So Mr. Bullett, how do we as an appellate court not address the ambiguity issue if your argument is that the lower court erred by using the stipulated amount of $650,000 in assessing whether there was a increase or decrease for cost of living purposes? I don't know how we avoid that if that's your claim.
And Judge Flory, I don't know that you need to avoid it. I think it would be sufficient for this court to say the language in the party's decree that says not once but twice that this language applies to any future modification motion would be sufficient. I think an analysis similar to what this court conducted in Graycheck to say, let's look at this language as a whole. do we have any evidence from the text of the language from in the within the four corners of the document itself that it was intended to apply to cost of living adjustments? In Graycheck, this court said, even an agreement that purports to extend to no changes in maintenance, right? Graycheck purported to waive any ability to change maintenance. That language in and of itself was not sufficiently clear to waive the right to a statutory COLA. We would say the language here is even less ambiguous, not ambiguous at all. In comparison to Graycheck, the parties made a specific proviso with respect to how maintenance could or should be modified and the standards that would apply. They didn't purport to do that. So certainly this court, to maybe hit your question more directly, Judge Flory, could raise this question of ambiguity. Did the court, you know, inherently or implicitly purport to construe the language of the decree? Did it make an implicit finding of ambiguity? If it made such a finding, the court would review that de novo, and it would determine whether the words on this page are reasonably susceptible to more than one construction. Given the explicit language used by the parties, they are not.
So assume, certainly I'm not speaking either for myself or the other judges on the panel here, but assume we agree with you that the court erred by using this $650,000 stipulated amount. What are you arguing the result of that should be? Are you suggesting that we should reverse the court's order outright, which would disallow the increase? Or does this matter need to be remanded for an analysis under 518A.75, which really is a discretionary standard, because it seems it says the court may adjust. It doesn't say shall. So it seems to me there may be some factors. The court might look at this and say, maybe the income went down a little bit, but this is still a lot of money and wife's cost of living has gone up and you can afford it. I mean, it seems to me that might be an outcome that could result here. So, I mean, you think if we would agree with you that this matter needs to be remanded to do a full analysis without relying on the stipulated amount under 518A.75?
It's an excellent question, Judge Flory. And in part, it's the different readings the parties have of the record. So it is appellant's position that reversal is appropriate here because the record as a whole has only one set of facts, which the court seemed to accept as at least largely true, which is that Dr. Thomas's income is down, and it's down on any measure. And while this court has affirmed adjustments when there's been some increase, right? Bratz, McClellan, Blomgren, Prodsen, all of which have said the increase doesn't need to correspond precisely to inflation, but there has to be an increase. In the absence of any increase, reversal is appropriate. And we see that particularly in Maurer County versus Human, in which a party's income that's going to be flat and that does not allow for cost of living increases doesn't support the imposition of a cost of living increase under 518A.75. Beyond that, though, I think to the court's point, even if you disagreed with that reading of the record, or if the court found that Bratz and Human and Hagen don't resolve the need to reverse here, even if we accept respondents' arguments as true, and we accept respondents' position that the court simply didn't make a finding here, you're absolutely right. What that would require at a minimum is remand to actually calculate what Dr. Thomas's income was. Would suggest further that reversal is also probably particularly appropriate here because in cost of living adjustments, this is a self-correcting problem, right? As the court pointed out in its decision in Hagen, just because the appellant's income has declined in any two-year period and the cost of living adjustment is denied, doesn't mean they're denied for all time. It simply means they're denied for this period. And so if 2 years from now, Dr. Thomas's income is back up, Ms. Chevalier will have the ability to come back and seek that cost of living adjustment.
What emphasis should we put on the fact that that your client, Dr. Thomas, previously in 2018 did not object to the cost of living adjustment being applied?
I think the weight you place on that, Judge Werke, actually favors Dr. Thomas's position, which is that when his income is increased, he hasn't disputed the adjustment. This is not someone who's returned to court at every turn to suggest that not one more penny of maintenance. When his income was up at the end of 2017, he said, absolutely, fair is fair, the CPIU is increased, here's your COLA. It's only when his income declined, $100,000 from that 2017 high through the end of 2019, and then another $150,000 with the advent of COVID, that Dr. Thomas returned to court and said, not only is my income down, it's down substantially. And I think, Judge Flora, you put it well, we are talking about big income figures here, and nobody would deny that. But we're also talking about big maintenance figures, $21,000 a month, as well as a big income reduction figure. Dr. Thomas has lost more income than most people earn. And it's precisely that reason that he's asked that the court stop this cost of living adjustment. That doesn't preclude, again, a reassessment another 2 years from now as to whether his income is back up and whether under different facts, a cost of living adjustment may be appropriate at that time. I see my time is up, so I will conclude unless there are additional questions.
It appears not. Respondent counsel? A reminder to unmute Ms. Gallagher.
It always does help, Your Honor, doesn't it? Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Susan Gallagher. I represent the respondent in this matter, Maureen Chevalier. As Mr. Blett has suggested, there's two issues in this case. The first issue is whether the court erred by using the $650,000 to set the base for spousal maintenance and applied it to the cost of living. And the second, in our opinion, is whether appellant met his burden of proof showing that he had insufficient income to support a cost of living adjustment. It's our position that the court properly reviewed the entire document as a whole and determined that the baseline income used to establish spousal maintenance was $650,000. And that income was a derivation from his income in 2014 solely from Ms. Park Nicollet income, which at the time they agreed was $654,000. So now going forward in this case, the court had applied that income to the cost of living adjustment. We believe it was the clear intent to do so. I know that Mr. Bullett has claimed—
Ms. Gallagher, can I stop you just for a minute and ask, can you point me to the language in the stipulated judgment and decree that you feel indicates the intention of the parties and clearly indicates that the $650,000 should be applied also to the COLA adjustment?
Your Honor, I think I don't think it's specifically stated, but it's also not precluded. And it's interesting. So you can go both ways with it. One is saying, okay, $650,000 is the baseline for spousal maintenance. It is the derivation of his $654,000 from Park Nicollet. But then there's nothing in it that says what is supposed to be used for it. There is certainly nothing that says that it is gross income from all sources that must be used. So if you take appellant's argument that he must use income from all sources, he didn't meet his burden of proof by establishing that, because the income that he gave to the court was solely his income from Park Nicollet at the time that he produced that document, which we think was wholly insufficient. A single paycheck from May 31, 2021, showing five months of income of $407,877.50. So what the court did in looking at that income, they extrapolated that, they gave him credit for what he claimed was an adjustment of about $50,000 for the subsequent 7 months of the year, and came up with a total of $764,548 solely from Park Nicollet.
But didn't the court also then tie that to the $650,000 stipulation, saying that even at $742,000, it's still substantially more than the amount the parties stipulated to as a baseline?
In part they did, Your Honor. And I think the difference, Judge Flory, is that Mr. Thomas did not produce income from his exam works income, which even if you look at his exam works income, and if you look at appellant's reply brief, it's a nice little graph for you to look at about what his income had been over the course of time. And even if you take his lowest number in 2017, which is $285,525 for exam works, he didn't say, I've not earned this from exam works. He wants to say it's only my income from Park Nicollet that must be applied, and you must only use that one, but you can't use my gross income, which was stated over in the findings of fact saying that it was about $954,000 was his gross income at the time of the judgment and decree. So whether if the court did err by applying the $650,000, it still demonstrates that respondent didn't meet his burden of proof in his
Ms. Gallagher, if I could jump in here, I'm wondering, I noticed that there was a motion for amended findings that I believe on behalf of appellant, but was there any motion for amended findings from your side regarding the income findings that the court did make? Because it sounds like you're saying that those findings were an error, and they may have been, but I'm just curious to see whether that was an argument through your option for amended findings that was ever made.
Your Honor, we did not oppose the judge's order in those findings. We thought that they were sufficient. We think they're sufficient, but we also did argue that his income that he produced was not sufficient. We did say that his income when he gave it to the court didn't include his income from exam works. We also noted that he has had draws over the course of time that he didn't demonstrate either that he had a draw that he'd not taken or that he was able to take draws to increase his income. So those were our arguments at the time, but we didn't dispute the court's finding at that time, Your Honor. So one of the things that Mr. Boulette has stated is that Mower County represented that there was no increase in a cost of living adjustment that should be applicable. And I think the critical thing about Mower County is that the court didn't find exactly what Mr. Boulette is stating, that what the court found in Mower County is that this was an annuity that he was drawing as a source of income, and annuities had no cost of living adjustments. And so they didn't apply the cost of living adjustment to the annuity in Mower County. So Mower County is not applicable to this case for that application. Mr. Boulette and appellant rely heavily on Graycheck. The court in the district court disregarded Graycheck. I think Graycheck was simply a case of first impression, looking at whether or not the absence of language precluded a new, whether the absence of language awarding a cost of living adjustment was fatal to a request for a subsequent cost of living adjustment. And the court concluded it was not. It is not applicable on its face to this case here, in our opinion. So we are asking that the court, we think that the baseline of $650,000 was appropriate. And the reason that we think it was appropriate is that it was not only used to establish spousal maintenance, but it was also used to modify spousal maintenance. And we talk about this. We talked about what a cost of living adjustment is and what a modification is. We agree that they're two different things, but the issues about they are both adjustments, they are both modifications, they are both alterations, they are both changes in income. The difference between a COLA and a modification is simply the process and the analysis used to get to the end result. It does not mean that they're not alterations or changes. And we think
there are different factors that are considered for each of them, though. I mean, in the modification statute, there's about six or seven grounds that would have to be met. That's not the issue for a COLA adjustment.
That's true. That's very true, Your Honor. We're saying that simply, if you look at the term modification, whether you use modification as a term of art or whether you use it as the application simply to the spousal maintenance modification statute, they're all alterations. They're all adjustments. So it's, you know, it maybe not the argument du jour that we should consider here, but it is also something about help support that the baseline is there.
I guess, Ms. Gallagher, the piece, go ahead, Judge Fly. I was going to take us in a different direction. If you have a follow-up, I think you should go ahead.
My only question is the same question I had for Mr. Boulette. You know, if we were to decide that the court's reliance on the baseline 650 was an error, is a remand, from your point of view, necessary for the court to fully address without the influence of that stipulated amount, the COLA adjustment under 518A.75?
Well, I think it is, Your Honor. I think a remand would be necessary to take a look at that. It's my hope that the court would find that $650,000 is the baseline language to be used in this case to resolve this issue for the parties. But I also agree that if the court finds that that was an error, that there does need to be a complete analysis of the income that Mr. Thomas submitted at the time of his submission to take a look at whether that is a demonstration of insufficient income. We think on its face it is insufficient, but I think a remand to the district court for that finding would be appropriate.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge Bryan.
Sure. Ms. Gallagher, I guess I want to take you back to the language of the provision itself. And I think the pertinent paragraph begins by saying spousal maintenance shall be subject to cost of living adjustments. But then it goes into a very specific language. For purposes of any future motion to modify spousal maintenance based on a substantial change in circumstances, right? And then if you go on to the next sentence, additionally, for purposes of any future motion to modify spousal maintenance based on a reduction in respondents' income. So those are not just specific to motions to modify as opposed to any adjustment, one kind of adjustment, a motion to modify. They're also specific as to the grounds under which the motion is made. And so if you read along that second part, additionally, for purposes of any future motion to modify spousal maintenance based on a reduction in respondents' income due to retirement or otherwise, then there's a comma, it shall be assumed that, and then there's two clauses. It shall be assumed that one and that two. And what we're talking about is the second part. It shall be assumed that any reduction in income shall be measured from $650,000 per year, even if actual income was higher than that. So I guess the question I have for you is, how is it possible for us to look at that language and interpret it such that it applies to the cost of living adjustment when the language itself is limited to motions to modify spousal maintenance based on reductions in income, respondents' income?
So I think, Judge Bryan, that the $650,000, it's clear that that was used to establish the spousal maintenance amount, and it was not used to establish the using his gross income. So I think that that's an indicator from that perspective. I think the other indicator is that there is nothing in here to preclude the use of that $650,000 to establish a modification based on a cost of living adjustment.
Well, I'm not sure that's the case because you have the introductory language that says you assume this for a specific purpose. And we're not in that specific purpose. We're in some other purpose. And so I think there is some meaning behind that language of saying, assuming for this specific purpose, $650,000. So it does seem to me that there's an indication that that was limited to one specific purpose, and you're asking us to interpret it to apply to multiple purposes.
I agree that it's interesting, Your Honor. I don't know what to make of that ultimately. I think that the issue from my perspective is the absolute silence on what would be applied to a cost of living adjustment and what factors should be considered. And the fact that we've got, $954,000 of income in 2014 from his exam works and from his Park Nicollet employment, and then he only provides his income from Park Nicollet, it's seeming to allege at least that his Park Nicollet income was the only income that should be considered, which is again that $650,000.
But that again, I think there's a separate argument that you likely have. Looking at the cost of living adjustment statute, there's a way to determine income, and maybe you're right that gross income should be included and that the district court should have found his income to be higher than it did for purposes of this decision on whether to waive the COLA adjustment. And that potentially goes to why this maybe is better for a remand than an outright reversal, because we need to have something from the district court applying the correct statute if we agree with Mr. Bullett's interpretation of that contract. But I guess I'm still stuck with the first argument, which is that the contract or the stipulation itself somehow allows for the district court to use 650 for a COLA adjustment when the language is limited to not just motions to modify spousal maintenance, but motions to modify spousal maintenance which are based on a specific reason that isn't present here.
Right. I understand that, Your Honor. I think that is a difficult issue here. I mean, I think we had a limited argument in relationship to that, but there's no other argument to the alternative except that there's nothing in there to preclude the use of that. And whether that is reasonable under the circumstances to use the $650,000 as a base, I think is probably the sufficient argument that we have, whether it's sufficient under the circumstances in interpreting section two of the findings, or excuse me, the conclusions of law, that I think that is a question for this court to make a determination.
It also seems somewhat telling to me, Ms. Gallagher, that the language used in the stipulation is for purposes of any future motion to modify. There's no need for a motion for a COLA under the statute, but the parties here specifically anticipated a motion to modify, which I think, you know, supports Judge Bryan's concerns and how we should interpret this stipulation.
Well, I would be foolish to disagree, Your Honor. You know, I do think that is, I think it is an issue. I think it is an issue. I think the issue here is really the sufficiency of the evidence that Mr. Thomas offered. I think the court got, you know, maybe stuck in the $650,000. We think it was, you know, because of the lack of preclusion, we think it was reasonable. But I think if this court does not believe it was reasonable, then a remand would be what we would request that this court proceed with. I thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gallagher. And Mr. Bullett, back to you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Two primary points that I think bear focus here. The first
before you
is,
get started, Mr. Bullett, I don't know if you're going to cover this or not, the elephant in the room here is why wasn't the exam works income included in this motion before the court? And maybe you were going to address that. And is that problematic?
So I'll lead with that because I was going to take it in reverse order, but we'll lead with exam work. It is incorrect to say that Dr. Thomas argued that his income decrease should not include anything from exam works. The exam works income was not in question. If we look at Dr. Thomas' works income, and the reason we provide the table on page 6 of our reply brief is for precisely this reason, it is remarkably consistent over time, right? But a low of $285,000 to a high of $301,000. When the district court analyzed Dr. Thomas's income, it began with his all-in income, his all-in figure that included exam works, and then removed the $150,000 decrease Dr. Thomas would experience from his primary employment. That is how the district court gets to the $914,000 figure that is in finding of fact 11, actually page 2 of appellant's addendum. So the exam works income is baked in. And candidly, if we just look to the income decrease from Dr. Thomas's primary employment, there is no way that the exam works income, whether we take it at its 2017 low or at its 2018 high, is sufficient to make up the difference between what Dr. Thomas has lost and where he would need to get to have experienced any increase in income at all since the last time the cost of living adjustment was implemented, or even from when the divorce was there. So why isn't this income in the record? In many ways, Your Honor, it is in the record, right? Dr. Thomas provided his tax returns so that the court has 16, 17, 18, and 19 exam works figures. There's no sense in which this income was hidden, but it's 1099 income. It's independent contractor income. Dr. Thomas may not have had the ability to gain easy access to those income documents immediately in advance. More to the point, there's also an element of relevance here. If Dr. Thomas's income was down $150,000, as demonstrated by his year-to-date pay stub, there's not an argument here that, oh, and I've also lost my exam works income, so I need you to consider that too. The argument was, if I've already lost $150,000, if I'm already down below the levels I was at all the way back in 2014, how much more of an income reduction do I have to show when what the statute requires to impose a cost of living adjustment is an increase in income? Now, again, not a set level of increase, but at least some level of increase before we impose a COLA. So the issue of exam works is in many ways a red herring. The district court had a significant amount of information, and when it calculated that $914,000 figure, it used 2019 exam works levels of income and worked backwards from them. With respect, though, to the legal issue, respondent's position has been that silence is enough here. Silence is enough to allow the district court to pour an agreement that had one specific kind of relevance into another area. And this court's decision in Graycheck stands for exactly the contrary proposition. In the absence of a clear and specific intent by the parties to waive their right to statutory COLAs, including the statutory right to contest a COLA, there needs to be language in the decree to that effect. There isn't that language here. Silence is not enough to say that the plain meaning of the words in the party's contract, the words in their decree, mean something other than what they've said. What the district court did here is it took language that was unambiguously related only to the modification of maintenance. It applied it to the cost of living adjustment. And then even according to its own findings, it ignored a decrease in Dr. Thomas's income since the 2014 figure that appears in the divorce decree, since the 2016 income he actually earned in the year of the divorce, and since the 2017 income figure that would have reflected the most recent period in which Ms. Chevalier received her cost of living adjustment. Because the district court erred as a matter of law in its application of the party stipulation, and because it failed to recognize that cost of living adjustments are not appropriate where a party's income is decreased, Dr. Thomas asked this court to reverse.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for appearing today. The matters were extremely well briefed, as well as the arguments that were presented. The matters are submitted, and a decision will be issued in the 90-day statutory timeframe.